It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
You're mentioning about Cuomo's press conference. That's why the president was offering hope of a light at the end of the tunnel yesterday, saying that it's encouraging that there is a slight decline in deaths in New York. But as you mentioned, the nation's top doc says that the worst we've seen is about to bear down on us in unimaginable ways.
This is going to be the hardest and the saddest week of most Americans' lives, quite frankly. This is going to be our Pearl Harbor moment, our 9/11 moment, only it's not going to be localized. It's going to be happening all over the country.
This as hospitals are becoming overwhelmed and critically needed medical supplies like those masks and ventilators still in short supply. It's prompted the governors of some of the hot spots to take the president to task for not doing enough. But it's a charge he refutes, saying this.
When it comes to the ventilators, which are very complex, we are now building, we have now under construction literally thousands of ventilators. So far I think our projections on ventilators have been right.
Adding to the challenges, there are new allegations of China hoarding personal protective equipment being made by companies like 3M who make this N95 mask so critical. The administration says now they're looking at legal action possibilities. But on another front, we should point this out. There are 9 states who are left holding out from issuing stay-at-home orders. You see them here, Arkansas, Iowa, Nebraska, the Dakotas, Wyoming, Utah, Oklahoma, and South Carolina. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer is putting pressure on the White House to issue a national order, saying a patchwork policy is dangerous, but the Surgeon General says that we don't need to issue that order because I'm encouraging all of those states to take that final step, saying, hey, if you can't give us a month, give us what you can. Now, the Vice President holds a video conference with several governors today. This certainly will be front and center. We'll see where we go as we brace for a very difficult week.
All right, Sandy Rios with you, maybe and maybe not. That's what I would say to that. Happy to be with you. I hope you had a great weekend in spite of being confined to quarters. I hope you made the most of your worship time and your family time and tried to be smart about this, wise, knowledgeable, and yet keeping it all in perspective. The one thing that I guess I have to confess publicly it drives me crazy is when I hear Christians tell me they're doing great and they've got all these great things going on and it's not bad, it's wonderful, and God is in control. And I would just caution you, don't be flippant. And by that I mean, the true test of that, certainly God is in control, he's sovereign, but the true test of making a statement like that is losing your job, losing your savings, having your children lose their jobs, getting hungry, not being able to find food, having lots of people that you know die, then that kind of statement that seems to come out of our mouths so easily will have gravitas and meaning. But when you are actually enjoying your time, and it's kind of a faux crisis right now, F-A-U-X, Dr. Fauci is leading it. I think we have to be careful about acting as though we're expressing great faith when we're really not suffering at all. I just want to caution you. I also think, you know, if God chooses to bring something like this to us as a sort of a judgment, it will not be faux. It will be real. And I'm not saying real people aren't dying. I'm just saying the numbers are not, there's something not quite right about all of this, and I don't know what it is. I'll offer some kind of examples as I can this morning, but still just ponder and think. Maybe it's time for us to just be quiet and think and let God move and work in us and prepare our hearts for something real in the future, and just kind of examine our own hearts and our own response. And again, as I said last week, be willing to just offer up everything, including our whatever wealth we have, and of course that's a relative term. I'm talking about abundance and plenty and not hungry and jobs. Offering that up, not even clinging to that, not clinging to the lives of our family members, our own lives, not clinging, not scared to lose anything, but willing to give it all when that moment comes. But it's not here yet. So anyway, I want to say Governor Cuomo, of course, the president has been warning of a rough week, the Surgeon General, the most dire of predictions. I remember the president had wanted to open up the economy on Easter, and then suddenly the model showed us that, oh, no, in fact, more people than ever would be dying around Easter. And so that's what they're allegedly bracing us for. This is what Andrew Cuomo said yesterday, though. Pretty interesting. Clip 14.
The number of deaths over the past few days has been dropping for the first time. What is the significance of that? It's too early to tell. Blip, maybe, in the data, or hopeful beginning of a shift in the data. And the discharge rate is way up, and that's great news.
Yeah, that's the first drop so far. The hospital levels are starting to perhaps decrease. We wish Governor Cuomo and all of the people in New York great.
Yes, so the numbers are dropping in New York, but Cuomo cautions that it might be a blip. Well, it might be a blip, but it is interesting. Here's the first part of this week where it's supposed to be the worst. Prepare. It's going to get horrible. 150,000, 200 may die. And now we have this indicator that, well, maybe not. And I'll just give you some more indicators. Sean Davis, who's the co-founder of The Federalist, actually looked at some of the metrics on these models, and he found that the actual numbers of hospitalizations on April 1st were a fraction of the numbers projected by the model, which is what Fauci and the other doctor have been using. The problem with the model, Sean discovered, is that it uses New York and New Jersey data and applies it to the rest of the states. So the actual numbers range from a low of 9% in Tennessee of the projection to a high of 50% in Virginia. So here's some examples. In Texas, the projection of their model was 1,716. The actual number of deaths, 196. In Georgia, projection, 2,777. Actual, 952. Virginia, projection, 607. Actual, 305. Tennessee, projection, 2,214. Actual number of deaths, 200. New York, projection, 50,962. Actual number, 18,368. Now, this is from Sean Davis. But of course, well, what would he know? I'll tell you somebody that would have an opinion who's getting a tremendous pushback on what he's saying publicly is a guy named Alex Berenson. Alex is a former writer for the New York Times. And I read a series of tweets of his last week that was stunning. I don't think I read them to you, but rather than that, he was on with Tucker Carlson. His wife, by the way, is a physician in the New York hospital system. This is what he had to say, clip 8.
So here's what I would say. I'm not an epidemiologist, okay? I'm not a scientist. And to some extent, right, I come at this from the same perspective that I came at when I wrote Tell Your Children, which, as you mentioned, we've talked about a couple of times, which is I'm a journalist. And what I think I'm pretty good at is seeing whether what people say lines up with what's really happening. And unfortunately, what we are seeing and what we have seen for the last couple of weeks is that the models that have predicted really apocalyptic things in places like New York City and nationally and in the UK don't seem to be matching what's going on in reality. And in some cases, these epidemiologic models are extremely new. They've gone extremely south in a matter of days. And so I think we really have to ask what's going on here and whether or not there are strategies that might be less damaging to the economy that would do just as well, because we've taken huge steps. We've put 10 million people out of work, more actually, because that's the official numbers, in just a couple of weeks. We've caused real societal harm and disruption, and we've done it on the basis of models that don't seem to line up with reality in real time.
Yeah, Alex goes on to project. He gets kind of he's a novelist also, and he wrote a very interesting, sort of like a mini novel about an epidemiologist in New York City who said these outrageous things about a pandemic. And when he said these things, suddenly he had sort of an average career. Suddenly he's like getting incredible attention. And so he makes even more outrageous predictions and he gets more attention and more and more. And he develops the whole thing. And he's indicating that he actually thinks that might be what's happening here. He goes on, Alex, to Tucker Carlson, to talk about the models themselves. Alex Berenson, a former New York Times reporter. Let's listen.
Most recent one is the University of Washington model, which was created and released only a week ago. And as of today, predicted that as of today, there would be about 50,000 people in New York State hospitalized with coronavirus. And there are about 12 or 13,000. So this is a model that the numbers in a week have been off by a factor of four. And that's also true for ICU beds. I think the delta there is about 3 to 1. Meanwhile, there's a state model actually in Oregon that's gotten very, very little attention that was just revised on Monday to show that if Oregon did nothing, if it ended the lockdown, that this is the state's own prediction, is that there would be 90 people in ICU beds at the beginning of May. This is a state with more than 4 million people. If the lockdown continued, there'd be 30 people. So that's about 2 people a day different being in ICU versus not. And the question is, are we going to lock the state of Oregon down, cause real societal disruption? In some cases, close schools, force kids, you know, to be home with parents who in some cases may be very stressed, maybe abusive. They're going to be out of sight of teachers. I'm very, very worried about the domestic violence and the child abuse implications of what and economic harm is real harm. So to me, the question is not, should we do something? Of course we need to do something about this. The question is, do these massive lockdowns make sense when we can't even necessarily figure out how they're working?
You can only imagine the blowback that Alex Berenson, former New York Times reporter, is getting from what he's saying publicly. Trust me, I've read some of the responses to his tweets. But it's not just the United States that's suffering or being the recipient of these wildly inaccurate models. Also, Israel, they had a forecast that they would have tens of thousands of deaths. And you know what? I don't know if that's deaths, and it's the infection rate, that they would have tens of thousands of infections and they have less than 1,000 deaths. And so the model there has not worked either. I want to move to something else because, look, I've thrown you a lot of things. The bottom line of that is I'm not sure what we're hearing is true. And that's what I've been saying for over a week at least. I'm just not sure. What is true is what you actually see. What is reality is what you can actually see. I notice when I see these pictures of hospitals that are supposedly overcrowded and suffering, I saw one shot where there was a room filled with a massive amount of hospital beds, but it was a shot where the beds were small. You saw hospital staff all, suited up, but you didn't see people in the beds. You know, I heard that the USS Comfort, as of last Friday, I think was the last count I had got, they had 12 patients, or maybe it was a couple of dozen patients on board. That's the hospital that's supposed to be the overflow for the New York hospitals, which are allegedly filled up with COVID-19 people that are dying. And so this USS Comfort was, the Cuomo kept begging for help and said medical help. The president did. And there's like 24 people, no more, on that ship. So I'm just telling you, truth is what lines up with reality. What we actually see, what the numbers are, that's what's true, not projections, not models. And so just keep that in mind. I want to take a pause in talking about all of this because we have a very special guest coming up next. The Office of Civil Rights for the Health and Human Services Director, Roger Severino, has done incredible things since he took his position in 2016. And the office just issued some directives in regard to help doctors and medical personnel treat people with disabilities and age differences. It's actually pretty fascinating. And because he's done so much that I think you're going to be so grateful for, I wanted you to meet him. So we'll talk to him next, Roger Severino, when we return. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Spring Share-a-thon is coming, April 14th through 16th.
Hi, my name is Tony Bird. I'm from Wichita, Kansas, and I just wanted to, I've listened since the early 90s or mid-90s, and just wanted to thank you for what you do. I was a Mormon and started listening to your station back in 1996 or so, and just really was challenged with what I heard and had people praying for me, but make a long story short, you guys really made a big impact in my life, and I became a Christian and an Army mission in Panama after that, and been going for Jesus ever since. So thank you for your ministry. Lord bless you.
By the grace of God, and with your help, AFR is making a difference. Join us for our three-day Spring Share-a-thon, April 14th, 15th, and 16th. And thank you for standing with American Family Radio.
During this coronavirus pandemic, even though we've been told to keep our distance from one another, we can still speak to each other and share a smile. And remember to check on friends and neighbors to be sure their needs are met. If someone is self-quarantined, offer to pick up their groceries when you get your own. And let's not forget to pray for one another. Sharing the love of Christ is the best response to this crisis. The President's coronavirus guidelines also include the following advice. Avoid discretionary travel, like shopping trips and social visits. Do not visit nursing homes or long-term care facilities unless you're going to provide critical assistance. And practice good hygiene. Wash your hands, especially after touching any frequently used item or surface. Avoid touching your face. If you must sneeze or cough, do it into a tissue or the inside of your elbow, and disinfect frequently used items and surfaces as much as possible. Do your part to slow the spread of coronavirus. For more information, visit coronavirus.gov.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
What do you see for the next generation? Do you see a prospering nation? Do you see hope? The future is ours to create. And Liberty University is driven to train positive influencers for our country and our culture. Our mission is to guide students toward leadership as servants of the people, defenders of freedom, and champions of truth. Discover how you can impact the next generation of champions for Christ by texting GIVE to 839-858.
There is grim news to report from New York City. Cardiac arrest patients will no longer be transported to hospitals if they do not have a pulse. The decision was made to protect first responders from the coronavirus. Now, typically, if someone has had cardiac arrest, such as a heart attack or severe trauma, EMS units would try and take that person to the hospital, even if there's no blood flow. Now, paramedics will still render aid in the field, but if that person cannot be revived on the scene, that's it. WNBC reports the newly implemented order was an effort to control the surge of patients in hospitals due to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. The order was issued by the Regional Emergency Medical Services Council, a body that governs New York City's emergency medical services. It is part of the grim new reality that medical workers face in the nation's largest city. And all we can do and all we must do is pray. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. How interesting that Todd Starnes should, in his commentary, talk about something sort of related to our next discussion. You know, who makes those decisions about who gets treatment and who doesn't get treatment? Well, sometimes it's states, sometimes it's medical personnel. And sometimes the federal government has to step in. And that's actually what we're going to talk about this morning. Roger Severino is the director of the Office for Civil Rights at Health and Human Services. That's Alex Azar is the head of Health and Human Services. You've seen him at a lot of these briefings because obviously Health and Human Services is very connected in what's happening in the government's pushback on coronavirus. But the Office of Civil Rights is a division of that. Roger is the head of that. And so you probably didn't know that Health and Human Services had an Office for Civil Rights, but they do. And you probably would not know until we talk now how many things they have accomplished under Roger's leadership. And so, Roger, with all of that said, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Fanny. How are you?
I'm good. You know, Roger, let me give you a better introduction here, because before this you were with Heritage Foundation as their director of the Religion and Civil Society Institute for Family, Community, and Opportunity. You also were with the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division. You must know, you probably knew our good friend J. Christian Adams. And you also worked for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. But I think probably the most important qualification you have for my audience is that you are the husband of Carrie Severino. You think that's possible?
Yeah. Carrie is an amazing woman. She's a force of nature.
She really is. She really is. I totally agree with that, Roger. And behind every good man and woman is a good man and woman, and that you guys are a great example of that. Before we get into the particulars of what we are going to talk about this morning, can you sort of give us an idea, Roger? You came in 2016. You were appointed by the president. Of the kinds of things that you feel are the hallmarks of the achievement of that office so far?
Well, we launched a conscience and religious freedom division, and first time ever in the federal government where we actually give our preeminent civil right its due. We have civil rights offices throughout the federal government, and of course, race, sex, national origin, age, and disability discrimination, those are the traditional civil rights that are coming out of the civil rights movement. But our right to religious expression and free exercise preceded the Civil Rights Act. It's part of the First Amendment, yet we didn't have any sort of focus. It was the left behind civil rights. And I had worked at the Beckett Fund and also at DOJ's Civil Rights Division, working on religious freedom issues there. And I noticed this gaping, missing hole of the whole constellation. One of the brightest stars was missing of what we should be protecting. So I launched a conscious religious freedom division. And we have federal career staff, incredible professionals, to make sure we have the focus and attention that right deserves, just like every other civil right. And we've brought the attention to the world that this right is important. We're in business. We mean it. When the laws say what they say, and we're going to enforce it. And we've had tremendous success in the first 2 years since launch.
Yes. Okay. So now, you know, because you're talking to people that are not in Washington and they're not doing government and they don't know these words and they don't know actually what you did do, Roger, give them specific examples of how that applied, conscious and religious freedom section.
Okay. For example, with the state of Vermont, there's a medical center and a university that actually effectively tricked a nurse into assisting in an abortion after she had told her bosses that she objected because it was contrary to her religion. She entered the practice of medicine to help save lives, and then she was forced, on pain of losing her job and potentially her license, to participate in the taking of an unborn life. And our office has jurisdiction. When you receive federal funds, you cannot discriminate against healthcare professionals that refuse to assist in abortions. It's fairly black and white. So we did our investigation, and we issued a notice of violation against this University Medical Center in Vermont, where they have to stop doing that and don't ever do that again, change their policies to come into compliance because they receive federal funds. That is a condition of federal funds. First time ever we have done a notice of violation under the law, and that is actually the Church Amendment. Regardless of what you think about abortion and Roe v. Wade, the American people have spoken with one voice to say you cannot force others to participate in it against their will. Similarly, with the state of California, they have issued a universal abortion insurance mandate where 28,000 people who had abortion-free insurance were forced off of their plans to add abortion. And again, this violates that common sense principle that you don't force people to pay for other people's abortions. This is even impacting an order of nuns in California who complained to us. Now, nuns don't usually need abortion insurance coverage ever.
Yeah, we've been through this before, haven't we? With Obamacare. Yeah.
Yes, this is history repeating itself, but now with California doing it. Yeah. The federal government went after the Little Sisters of the Poor over contraceptive coverage. The Obama administration forced it all the way to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court gave them protection. We rolled back that rule with help from people in our division. And then California doubled down with insurance, forcing nuns to buy abortion insurance. And we issued a notice of violation against the state for that action, saying it violates the Weldon Amendment because you're receiving federal funds. Again, the first time in history there's been a notice of violation under the Weldon Amendment. And it specifically reversed a decision from the previous administration So we've set all the things in motion to finally enforce the law and hold people responsible when they do not respect our first freedom of religion or our conscience protection laws that the people's representatives in Congress passed with large bipartisan majorities. So I'm very pleased to see that, and I hope that will be the legacy of my work there.
Oh, I think it most definitely will. And Roger, actually, you're modest. There have been so many rulings that we can't possibly get to them. You guys have turned back so many regulations. While people were not actually, well, in fact, you fell under a lot of harsh criticism, and they really targeted you at one point. I don't know, that's just been a few months ago. And there's so much news, it's hard to keep up. But you've become the target of the left because of the great things that you've done in that office. But let's talk about the latest one, because it relates to the coronavirus. You issued an order that there could be no discrimination in applying care for people who have coronavirus. First of all, let me ask you this. Did you have reports from inside this country of doctors or medical personnel discriminating against people that were older or people that were disabled? Did you have reports about that stuff happening?
There have been news reports about what are called crisis standards of care, which are the plans for triage in case of lack of resources. We've also received complaints against states and their crisis standards of care plans, and we've opened up an investigation, and we're hopeful that states that may have problematic provisions will cooperate with us to fix them. We don't have that much time. Right now, as of this moment, there is not the shortage that would require triaging. However, that may change. It may change within days. And that would put people in some very tough positions. When it's questions of life and death, when it's a question of who gets what resource and who could live or die, it's not ultimately a scientific relationship. It is actually a moral and legal one. We're making moral choices at that point. And there are legal guardrails. You can't discriminate on the basis of disability or age, which means you can't stereotype about people, and you also can't take into account their quality of life and say, you can't say a person with Down syndrome has a life that is not worth living compared to somebody who doesn't have Down syndrome, and therefore the person with Down syndrome doesn't get a ventilator. Those sorts of judgments don't belong in our system, and our civil rights laws are there to protect people against that sort of ruthless utilitarianism that isn't part of our national character. Everything must be done on an individualized basis based on the best objective medical evidence. And if we stick to that and those principles I just talked about, then we'll come out of this very dark and terrible time, at least keeping what's really important and core about America and our character, that we leave nobody behind, that we do everything we can, especially for those that are the most vulnerable.
You know, Roger, this, I'm sure that you know, but I'll tell you from personal experience, this whole move to give some people treatment and withhold treatment from others is not new. I'll first say, in more recent years, I've certainly seen doctors not give older patients treatments. For heaven's sake, we heard Barack Obama interact with a woman whose mother had a pacemaker. You may remember that exchange. And President Obama said under his health care plan, this is before it was implemented, someone her age would probably not get that, but you might get a pill or something. That's basically what he said. So the whole notion that we can't waste our resources on old people is not new in this culture. But I have to tell you, I had a severely disabled child, but when she was very small, but she was very precious to me. You know, she was my child. I loved her. She's not with us anymore, but I adored her. And she was very, very sick when she was sick. She was sick a lot, but this particular time was especially bad. And she would have these seizures where she would just turn blue. And I felt helpless, you know, to save her. And I remember she was in a hospital in Chicago. As in this particular time, it was a children's hospital. And I asked the doctor after she had recovered, I said, what can I do? How can I help her? How can I, when she gets in that moment and she's turning blue, what can I do? And he basically said to me, you should just let her die. I'll never forget that because she was only 6 years old. My point is that doctors in our medical schools have actually been implementing utilitarianism. And this is pretty radical, what you are proposing. Would you not agree?
Because there's been a history of mistreatment of persons with disabilities, That's why we have the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's why we have laws protecting people who cannot have a voice, people who are deaf or hard of hearing. We have laws that have preferential treatment for children. Right? The government steps in to help those who need it most, and we have to stay true to those principles, especially when we're at a time of resource allocation and constraints. We're not a utilitarian country. We don't separate the, quote, fit from unfit and judge people's worth based on how useful they are in some way or another. No, we believe everybody is created equal, and our laws reflect that, and we do everything we can to make sure everybody's treated fairly, even in tough circumstances. We cannot lose our humanity in these tough times. So we have to have those guardrails in place. Now, states have tremendous flexibility in how they do allocation of resources. There's a lot of tough calls to be made. My sister is an ER nurse. I also have parents who are approaching 80 and have underlying conditions. So the medical professionals need that guidance. They can't operate in the dark. We owe it to them that they have clear protocols in place, and we owe it to the patients to have clear protocols in place so that they know they won't be subject to discrimination or stereotypes or some vicious quality of life judgments. We're better than that as a country.
That is, listen, this is the beauty, honestly, Roger. What you have done is so profound, and I guess that's what I'm trying to express. It's more than just a rule change. You have sort of laid down a marker, reminding us of the American view that all life is precious. At any spectrum and whatever form it takes, that remember that little girl that fell in that well years ago, and the whole country was held spellbound, trying to get that 18-month-old child out of that well. It went on for days. It was one life, but that is really the way. It's kind of part of our DNA because of our Judeo-Christian background that we instinctively have treated life as. It's not the same way in China. It's not the same way in India, for instance, or Africa. We value life, and you've sort of set the line down again. Let's talk just quickly in the remaining couple of minutes we have. You've actually given some practical suggestions and provisions for, like, for instance, doctors treating disabled patients, like in terms of technology. Can you say something about that?
Oh, yes. There are multiple things we do in the Office for Civil Rights. So we do conscience and religious freedom, as I just mentioned, civil rights, race, sex, national origin, language access. People who don't speak English well cannot be put at the end of the line. We also do HIPAA, the privacy rules and laws. And because President Trump and Vice President Pence have mobilized the entirety of the federal government and mobilized the entirety of the American people to tackle this crisis, we're using every lever we can to ease the strain on the medical system. So HIPAA, of course, protects privacy of your information. However, we want to make sure it doesn't get in the way of treatment and saving lives. So we are saying that we will not issue monetary penalties. We won't fine institutions that use things like FaceTime or Skype or Zoom to provide medicine from people's home to the doctor's office. You could use your phone, have a video link, and you won't be violating, you won't be subject to HIPAA fines if you do that using what everybody's using now, all these very common communication video technologies, and we're allowing medicine to be delivered where it is, where people are, and CMS is paying for Medicare patients and Medicaid patients to be able to use telehealth so that people don't have to go to the hospital, and so doctors will not be faced with more difficult triage decisions because people are going to the hospital unnecessarily. Yeah. So we're doing everything we can under the president's leadership to tackle this crisis like we're at a wartime footing and making sure that there is no red tape and everything is done possible to save America from this time of need.
Roger, you're the best, honestly. We're going to put this this directive from your office on our Facebook page because there may be some disabled older people that have experienced this, and it provides kind of the guidelines, and we'll do that. So Roger Severino, Director of the Office for Civil Rights at Health and Human Services, we appreciate your valuable time, Roger, and I hope we can speak again sometime soon. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
So the chief priest made plans to put Lazarus to death as well. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. After Jesus resurrected Lazarus, his and Lazarus' fame spread. They already planned to kill Jesus, but now, because Lazarus was tangible evidence of Jesus' resurrection power, the chief priests and Pharisees plotted to kill Lazarus too. They never worried about Lazarus before, but now, because he is a walking billboard of Christ's power, they want him dead too. This, brothers and sisters, is why many come against you. It isn't personal, but satanic forces can't stand your representation of God's power to transform lives. That's why we rejoice when we're slandered for his name's sake. Christ's power is on display.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association. Cross-examined with Dr. Frank Turek.
Dr. Norman Geisler said elections are normally the choice between a known witch and a suspected devil.
Examining the role of Christians in a post-Christian society.
Since we don't have Jesus on the ballot, we're never going to have a perfect candidate. And quite often, we got to choose the least worst choice.
Cross-examined with Dr. Frank Turek. Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday afternoons at 4 Central on American Family Radio.
This is a unique moment in the history of our country where we have an opportunity to restore the foundations of this nation.
Tony Perkins of Washington Watch.
To a nation that once again honors God. It will not happen unless God's people are informed and engaged.
Join Tony Perkins for Washington Watch. Weekday afternoons at 4 Central and Saturday evening at 6 Central on American Family Radio.
I believe we have been vastly overreacting to coronavirus, reacting out of panic and fear rather than reason and science. It'll take decades to recover what we've destroyed. Scientists are saying the same thing. Dr. David Katz of the Yale University Prevention Research Center says in the New York Times, "I'm deeply concerned that the social, economic, and public health consequences of this near-total meltdown of normal life, schools and businesses closed, gatherings banned, will be long-lasting and calamitous, possibly graver than the direct toll of the virus itself. The stock market will bounce back in time, but many businesses never will. The unemployment, impoverishment, and despair likely to result will be public health scourges of the first order. There's a smart way to send people back to work. We need to start doing it today."
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Amid the endless warnings about Russian interference in our elections, another state actor's influence operations have been largely ignored. But a recent spate of anti-Trump advertisements that have been placed on Facebook and other social media platforms by Chinese Communist Party propaganda instruments without disclosing their sponsors demand attention and corrective action. The ads have run in English, Chinese, and Arabic, and are aimed at promoting the Communist Party line with audiences around the world. Their memes praise the PRC's effective action against the coronavirus, and they depict Donald Trump as a racist for pointing out China's responsibility for the present pandemic. Beijing's aggressive hostility towards President Trump, to say nothing of the overt effort to help defeat him that it animates, is unacceptable. Those who relentlessly warn about foreign election interference should be leaders in condemning and punishing what China is perpetrating. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
If all else is equal, why people that have received 5 days or more, even 4 days or more, of this hydroxychloroquine azithro regimen wouldn't get intubated? If the regimen didn't work, why would it just be the people that didn't get nearly complete the regimen? Most of the people were in the first 2 days.
Right, Dr. Smith, we're going to have you back. Yeah, it's a game changer, correct?
It's a game changer. It's absolute game changer. I think these data go to really support the French data. Now you actually have an intra-cohort comparison saying that this regimen works.
Dr. Smith, thank you for all the work. You and I and our medicine cabinet of folks and all your colleagues, thank you.
Laura, I think this is the beginning of the end of the pandemic. I'm very serious.
Now, that was a Dr. Smith with Laura Ingraham, and I just wanted you to hear that. He thinks that this the hydrochloroquine regimen is the beginning of the end. But there's controversy about that. I want to talk about that just for a second. I've been giving you stats various places of them doing, you know, sample groups and having incredible success. And you might remember that President Trump talked about this drug more than a week ago in one of his briefings. And he said, Dr. Fauci said, oh, no, we can't say that. And Dr. President Trump said, well, I'm personally very optimistic about it. And so now we've been watching how it's been used around the globe. It's being now manufactured hand over fist in this country and in other places, and it's just having incredible success. In fact, 6,000 doctors have been polled, international poll, 6,000 doctors. A majority of 6,200 doctors from 30 nations said that the drug was most effective. Doctors across Europe, the U.S., and China have been given license to prescribe it. The U.K. is dragging its feet until clinical trials show it is safe and effective. The thing of it is, it's been given for malaria for years. So it's a known drug with known side effects. It's not an unknown. And so the World Health Organization, on the other hand, is claiming that no medicine can prevent or cure the virus. Of course, the World Health Organization is led by a gentleman who was a prominent member of the Communist Party in his country. And he is the one that was chosen by the Chinese to head the World Health Organization. It was the World Health Organization that gave us bogus numbers and bogus facts about what was happening across the globe. They were the ones that covered for China. So it's hard to even listen to them at all. And now they weigh in to say that no medicine can prevent or cure the virus. But that's not what doctors are saying. You just heard Dr. Smith. He thinks it's going to be the beginning of the end. These 6,200 doctors from around 30 nations said it was very effective. I was going to give you some more numbers from that article, but I'm going to move to this one instead because this is really fascinating. Axios is reporting that just last night there was a blow up in the White House. Now, first of all, could I say Axios has these scoops all the time about things said in inside meetings in the White House. This was in the White House Situation Room. And I always I have to say I hate the fact that someone is on the inside leaking this stuff. So I'm not happy about that. But I am glad to have this information, and I'm going to share it with you. The White House Coronavirus Task Force had its biggest fight yet on Saturday. It was Saturday. Pitting economic advisor Peter Navarro against infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci. At issue, how enthusiastically should the White House tout the prospects of an anti-malarial drug to fight COVID-19? Now, the president has already said, I'm optimistic. I think this, and Dr. Fauci said, oh, no. You know, he's been the naysayer about it. And I've defended him because I know there are no clinical tests yet. These are experiential in the field. They're seeing great results, but they haven't had a test group. They haven't had long enough to do that, to see if people with coronavirus, what the sample is and the severity and all of that, which is what scientists want. I understand that. But we do have, according to them, out of their own mouths, an emergency, a great proportion. This is going to be a deadly week, they tell us. Fauci's quick to say that. But, no, not so quick about the hydrochloroquine, even though it's having good effect around the globe, according to doctors. Let me go on with this. This is this story out of the White House Situation Room on Saturday. Numerous government officials were at the table, including Fauci, Corona Response Coordinator Deborah Birx, Jared Kushner, Homeland Security Chief Secretary Chad Wolf, Commissioner of Food and Drugs Stephen Hahn. Behind them sat staff, including Peter Navarro, tapped by Trump to compel private companies to meet the government's coronavirus needs under the Defense Production Act. Toward the end of the meeting, Hahn, now that's the Commissioner of Food and Drugs, Stephen Hahn, began a discussion of the malaria drug hydrochloroquine, which Trump believes could be a game changer, that's his words, against the coronavirus. But of course, he's just a businessman. What does he know? We should listen to Anthony Fauci, who says, oh, no, even though people around the globe, medical personnel, are saying this thing is working. So, like I said, truth is what comports with reality. Just remember that. Truth is what comports with reality. Toward the end of the meeting, Hahn began the discussion of the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine, which Trump believes could be a game changer. Hahn gave an update about the drug and what was he was seeing in different trials and real-world results. Then Navarro got up. He brought over a stack of folders and dropped them on the table. People started passing them around. And the first words out of his mouth are that the studies that he's seen, I believe they're mostly overseas, show clear therapeutic efficacy, said a source familiar with the conversation. Those are the exact words out of his mouth. Navarro's comments set off a heated exchange about how the Trump administration and the president ought to talk about the malaria drug, which Fauci, and other public health officials stress is unproven to combat COVID-19. Well, unproven is one thing. Where it's actually happening, We're seeing people, you know, most people that take the drug recover from their symptoms and from the virus. That's reality. No tests, so we can't talk about it. Fauci pushed back against Navarro, saying that there was only anecdotal evidence that hydrochloroquine works against the coronavirus. Only anecdotal. Researchers have said studies out of France and China are inadequate because they did not include control groups. Fauci and others have said much more data is needed to prove that hydrochloroquine is effective. Well, yeah, okay. We can do the studies, and we can, as long as it has been in the market for a long time, treating malaria, and there are no side effects that seem to be alarming medical professionals, then it's having great effect, then why can't we give it? Why can't we be kind of excited about this? But no, says Fauci. As part of his role, Peter Navarro, has been trying to source hydrochloroquine from around the world. He's also been trying to ensure that there are enough domestic production capabilities inside the U.S. So he's vested in this, and he's having great success. This businessman, Peter Navarro, who advises the president, he's getting hydrochloroquine to be manufactured here. He's bringing it here. We've got lots and lots and lots of doses here in the country ready and available. By the way, I just read that in New York City, well, I could tell you this, Mario Cuomo is not allowing people to have hydrochloroquine. Now, New York is like in the horrible states, right? Desperate conditions. The hospitals overrun, more deaths than any place in the country. But the governor thinks, you know, his protocol for this is that if people are sick, their doctors cannot prescribe it. It's not available in pharmacies. The only way they could possibly get it is if they check into hospitals. Now, you go figure. You go figure that one for me because I can't. But I'm going to go back to the blow up in the White House. So Peter Navarro has been one overseeing getting this stuff available, making it available to you and to me. Should we be diagnosed with that? Fauci's mention of anecdotal evidence just, and this is a quote, just set Peter off, said one of the sources. Navarro pointed to the pile of folders on the desk, which included printouts of studies on hydrochloroquine from around the world. Navarro said to Fauci, "That's science, not anecdote." Navarro started raising his voice and at one point accused Fauci of objecting to Trump's travel restrictions, saying, "You were the one who early on objected to the travel restrictions with China." And of course, Navarro was the one who pushed the ban on China travel. So it said Pence was trying to moderate. And Jared Kushner got involved. And so between the lines, there was never been a confrontation in the task force meetings like the ones yesterday. People speak up and there's robust debate, but there's never been a confrontation. Yesterday was the first confrontation. I watched it wasn't an interview. It was a monologue, Tucker Carlson's monologue on Anthony Fauci. And I almost played it for you this morning, except it was so long. But he tracked Anthony Fauci's statements now through these months, through these weeks, and how all over the map he has been, and how wrong he's been about so many things. And yet we are trusting him and his female counterpart to make decisions that are having tremendous, tremendous effect on our life and on this economy that, again, are not necessarily playing out in reality. Now, we'll see. Maybe there will be 150,000 deaths this week, and I'm just kind of stirring you up for nothing. But we'll see, because, like I said, truth is what comports with reality. I want to talk for a second about a couple of things. I'm going to jump to this. It's kind of out of order here, but there is an election in Wisconsin tomorrow, a primary, and there's a lot of controversy over that primary. They are, you know, going in and scrubbing down the voting places. They're taking great precautions, and yet many people and many political operatives in Wisconsin wanted to stop. And the reason they wanted to stop, I'm just telling you, is because they want mail-in voting. They want mail-in voting. Wisconsin had enacted a voter ID law that's been very controversial with their leftist wing, and their governor's, you know, a leftist. And so they really want to go to this mail-in ballots, so that, you know, no one can really check who's voting, and we can harvest ballots and all kinds of things. And so I've talked to you a lot about, we did a whole show with J. Christian Adams and Hans von Spakovsky. If you missed it last Friday, we talked about the attempt to corrupt our voting system. And there's another article by Aaron Klein in Breitbart this morning, a George Soros group's pushing Democrat scheme for mail-in voting. And they're pushing a lot of things, but it traces the financial ties, which I've talked to you many times before. Soros Open Society Foundations are trying to change the way Americans vote. They have a plan. A lot of these senators like Amy Klobuchar and Chris Coons are using their plans and presenting it as legislation. They want universal vote by mail option for all voters. That means you don't know who's voting. If you send a ballot to someone's house, you have no idea who's filling it out. You have no verification of who they are or whether they're the person that you sent it to. A massive, massive fraud. And, of course, they're doing it in the guise of people's coronavirus. We have to be careful. We don't want people to be in danger. It's the perfect, perfect storm for them. And so that's what the battle is raging now in Wisconsin. I just don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, if they will really get to vote or not. And here's another interesting sideline. Mark Elias is a lawyer and the chairman of Perkins Coie Political Law Group. Now, Perkins Coie, that sounds familiar maybe, right? Well, maybe because Perkins Coie is the law firm that paid for the Russian dossier that was paid for through the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC. It's also the law firm that represents the Democratic National Committee, and they are pushing like crazy to change voting rules before November. And so they want to expand early voting to include weekend voting. One of the things that was pointed out in many of the articles I read is that they're pushing for Sunday voting so that you can have voting in churches, mainly black churches, because that's when black people congregate. Of course, white people congregate too, but they want to target black churches because they think they'll provide Democratic votes. And so that's the game plan on that. They think all states should adopt vote anywhere rules so that if a voter shows up at a voting place and can't show ID or isn't on the rolls, they should be able to vote anyway. You see how it works. They have a whole plan for all of us. And now, again, in Wisconsin, those of you in Wisconsin, this is a big controversy for you. So I don't know what's going to happen. And I can't really say to you, it's city and county officials responsible for this. So if you know city and county officials and you can weigh in, you should, because we should be voting in person, presenting our ID everywhere. This should be the law of the land everywhere. But every state has their own rules. Wisconsin has a pretty good voter ID law, but that's what they're trying to get around. So just be aware of all of that. Well, now here you go. It's Monday, and look, we should be optimistic. Hydrochloroquine is having great results. The president's fighting for it. The cases in New York are falling, even though the governor's quick to tell us that doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it might. So let's be optimistic. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.